Good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 012230, CSC Holdings Incorporated against Rizzitti. Mr. Klein.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Arthur Klein, and I'm representing defendants Frank Rizzitti Jr. and Frank Rizzitti Sr. We have three, I believe, basic propositions to present to this court. First, we believe there was significant unrebutted evidence that would have required the district court to have held that this suit was barred by the statute of limitations.
Was your statute of limitations argument one that covers the entire period, or are you just saying that damages were recoverable only from 97? It's hard for me to see how one could insulate an illegal sale in 1998 by having made an illegal sale in 1994.
Well, I think there are several aspects to the proposition. The district court applied the continuing violation theory. And I guess under that theory, you could make that argument. The continuing violation theory, it seems to me, is just, in a sense, arose by any other name.
No, but I'm asking you... They filed suit in 1999.
Yes.
If, as you argue, there is a two-year statute of limitations
or
based on the statute, or right, whatever it is, why are not sales made at least within that time period clearly covered by the lawsuit that's filed?
I think that is a fair proposition, but the point is.
And the record shows, we can tell from the record that there are, in fact, some sales made.
Yes.
In that time
during that period of time, but I think a bigger point is that as far as the undisputed evidence shows, we believe that at 1995 is the latest, plaintiff knew everything it knew in 1998 in order to trigger its investigation. There was unrebutted testimony that Mr. Astorita, their director of security, had been heavily involved in meetings with the FBI. He even gave an interview after the case was over, of course, saying that he knew back in the early 1990s that the Rizzittis were so-called cable pirates. And the statute of limitations test, and I'm not, I don't want to get into subjective reasons here, but it's an objective test. I think that's pretty well settled. And as of 1995, they knew everything they knew in 1998, which is when they claim they began their investigation. In fact, they claim they began their investigation in response to an article, and it was also undisputed that the last time it was it was also undisputed that the last time that ad ran was in 1995. So I think you certainly have a fair argument, more than a fair argument, whether they sat on the sat on their rights to load damages, so to speak, or whether they just didn't get around to it, and it is an objective test, that as of 1995, they knew every bit as much as they knew in 1998 when they claim they first began their investigation preparatory to a suit in 1999.
What about the fact that the Rizzittis changed corporate identity so frequently?
Well, assuming they did, I think
there are lots of different companies.
Yes, but the undisputed affidavits, and these were including affidavits by FBI agents, talked about the Rizzittis, not the companies. That there were meetings where the Rizzittis were discussed, presumably including the corporate changes and including the ads, which I think leads to the certainly what we consider a very significant, I don't want to call it a secondary point, but a second point. And that's that we think the district court abused its discretion in refusing them the opportunity to depose Mr. Astorita.
What was the reason given?
Well, I think the reason given was just no. I think to the extent the I'm sorry, excuse me.
Go ahead.
But I thought the district court said it was irrelevant in light of the fact that the district court concluded it was a continuing violation.
Well, the district court did say that, but I think, in a sense, that put the cart before the horse, because The continuing violation, Your Honor, it seems to me, is in large measure arose by any other name. Because the question is, under the continuing violation theory, as in any other test of limitations, it's when the defendant knew or should have known sufficient knowledge. And I think the Taylor case, the Taylor versus Myrick case, which the plaintiff heavily relies on, really makes this point. Taylor was held to be a continuing violation from, I believe, 1976 to 1979. I think it was a copyright infringement. The court held that it was undisputed that the plaintiff didn't find out about it until 1979, filed suit shortly thereafter, and also made the other point that it was, in the court held, and I guess it was, I'm not sure whether it affirmed or whether it held anew, this court, that it was reasonable, or not unreasonable, that plaintiff first got its knowledge in 1979. Now here what we're saying is that it's patently unreasonable, or at least arguably unreasonable, that plaintiff didn't get its first knowledge until 1998 or 1999.
When did it have enough knowledge to sue, to file a complaint without having Rule 11 kind of problems?
Well, certainly 1995. Or if you add a year, let's postulate for what they say. They say they first started an investigation in 1998 and they sued in 1999. If you assume, for the purposes of argument, and I hope more than that, the propriety of our position that they knew full well in 1995 everything they knew in 1998, then I guess...
But what did they know in 1998?
They knew in 1998.
Yeah, what did they
know? Let me back up for a second, Your Honor. Mr. Fame, who was their investigator, said that what triggered his 1998 investigation was an ad in a magazine called Nuts and Volts. And it was undisputed that the last time that ad appeared was in 1995. So he, to the extent he didn't find out about the ad in 1998, and to the extent that Astorita was involved in meetings up through 1995, in which that advertising, at least according to undisputed affidavits, including the affidavit of an FBI agent, discussed specifically the advertising in Nuts and Volts, it seems to me that...
But at what point in that continuum did this company, CSC, know that your clients were in fact doing harm to their operation?
I would say they were charged with that knowledge in 1995. If it wasn't clear, there was certainly enough there that we met the test to be able to depose Astorita to find out exactly what they knew and when they knew it. We certainly met the threshold.
And the ground for the district court believing his testimony or his deposition testimony would be irrelevant was the continuing violation, is that correct?
I surmise. The transcript...
You surmise.
The transcript
really
does say it's irrelevant.
He just says it's irrelevant.
The hearing transcripts say it's irrelevant. I don't believe he ever made a written ruling on the denial. It was an open court, and he said it's irrelevant. Plaintiff does make an argument, and I'd like to address that briefly, although I hate to say more than I have to, that there might have been a timing issue, that there had been a change of counsel, that the request came late, and to that I would add that they produced two other witnesses in response to that same notice.
When was the statute of limitations defense, when did it come into the litigation?
It was filed in an initial motion in response to the complaint, and then as an affirmative defense, and it was the subject of the cross motion for summary judgment.
Yeah, time-wise, when was
with
it?
The answer.
With the answer.
With the answer.
Not when the new firm came into the case.
No.
So it was hanging around.
The defense was timely raised. The new firm, and it was two, if I recollect, 2 days after they came in, filed a series of notices of deposition, including Astorita and two or three others. Two others were produced. They refused to produce Astorita.
When were these notices of deposition made in terms of the discovery process?
Shortly before the discovery cutoff. For the summary judgment. I believe the date was the 27th of August. It was shortly before the discovery, but On the other hand, they made another attempt to depose Astorita in connection with damages later on, when timing was not an issue, and once again, he wasn't produced and the district court permitted it. But he clearly, I think the argument they made was, well, he really didn't know anything about the lawsuit, and he was a high corporate executive. And I think the threshold test for deposition was more than adequately met here. This was not a situation that you see sometimes with harassing a high corporate executive. This was, and I don't mean to be overly colloquial with Your Honors, but I think this was the main man in the discovery. Interestingly, one of the people they did produce for deposition was Flame, who was also their damages expert. He was an investigator, who, the fellow who did the investigation of plaintiffs, and he was asked, well, you know, who knew all about the investigations in the early 1990s? And he said, well, I didn't. It was Mr. Astorita. So their own witness, I believe, has made the point that this was a very, very crucial man, it was, I think, clearly wrong for them to be denied, for the defendants to be denied, at the very least, even assuming that there's a question about the statute of limitations, the opportunity to test under oath what he knows. There are four or five pages in plaintiff's brief where you will find, and I think it's 25 to 28, something like that, where there's a lengthy discussion about Astorita's knowledge, and this is directed to limitations. And they say, well, this is what he knew, and it was just mere suspicion. We can't be charged with that. And with all due respect, I think that makes our point precisely, that this was a man who very much should have been deposed. It was very relevant to what was indeed a timely and very legitimate limitations defense, which really couldn't be fleshed out any more than with some affidavits of FBI agents, and I think that probably is unusual enough to have FBI agents submitting affidavits in this kind of a situation.
None of those affidavits really, though, make enough of a case to bring a lawsuit, do they?
Well, the affidavits, I don't know. It's obviously, the district court didn't think so, but I would disagree. I think that there's certainly enough there to have supported a limitations holding, and certainly more than enough to require that the defendants be granted the opportunity to test Astorita's knowledge under oath. I think that is just so crucial to this proposition. It certainly more than reaches the threshold question of what's required. And again, to the issue of timeliness, which is one of the elements, I don't think that was a real point. That was a point that they did argue a little bit in their brief. But I think that even then, and assuming that it was a genuine issue, I think there should have been and could have been some slack cut. This was a case where there was an injunction and an asset freeze already in place. There was $30 million that was asked. And if timing really was a problem, then I think the district court, with all due respect, abused its discretion in not giving the timing. It's certainly, Judge Williams, to answer your question, I don't think it was irrelevant to the limitations defense. I think it was very, very, very relevant.
Let me ask you something else. What do you make of the plaintiff's argument or theory that the violation just wasn't when each cable box was actually purchased, but it continued because every time a customer watched a premium or pay for view movie, there was a violation? So what do you make of that in terms of their theory of it being a continuing?
Well, I still go back to the point of when they had enough to raise the duty to go in and investigate and look at it. If it's a continuing violation, you can make the argument, with all due respect, that it ended for purposes of knowledge in 95. And that's kind of what the Taylor versus Myrick case says, that a continuing violation ends when the plaintiff or a reasonable plaintiff has enough knowledge to be required to make an investigation and do something to stop it.
But I wonder if you could, Judge Williams' question, I think, leads us in the direction of damages.
Yes.
Because the existing cable boxes appear to have had a useful life of some 7 years or so.
Well, that's an assumption that, of course, was...
Well, that's part of my question. You have attacked in your brief the formula the district court used to measure damages, but I'm interested to know to what extent you raised alternative measures at the trial level.
Well, actually, to answer your question, I think in the starkest terms, the defendants didn't feel they had the opportunity to raise any alternative methods. There were bare conclusions. They didn't have access to some crucial documents that could have tested it, including, for example, the customer lists and customer histories. And they were put in a position where the bare damages issue, and I see my time
is running out. You mean customer lists and histories, CSC's customers?
Yes. Yes, so that in the first place they could match them, test them to see if there was a very, very small random sampling they were able to perform on the basis of some documents that were accidentally produced, and that came out with about a 40% accuracy rate. So it's very hard to mount a damages defense, colloquially, without any ammunition. And, of course, we pointed out that the assumptions that Flay made were heavily criticized in a recent case in Texas, and he said, well, I got them from another case. That was his explanation, the usage, the rates, and that other case said it just can't pull them out of the air, this 2001 Texas case, new information. So I will try and save a couple of minutes for rebuttal with Your Honor's permission. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. We'll hear now from Mr. Lefkowitz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Daniel Lefkowitz of Lefkowitz, Lewis & Sullivan of Jericho, New York, on behalf of the Plaintiff Appellee, CSC Holdings, Inc., which I'll refer to as Cablevision. It's very clear in the record that the defendants started their illegal operation in 1990, and this was interrupted when the FBI served a search warrant on the illegal operation in 1992. The record is also clear that no one had an understanding that immediately after the search warrant was executed, the defendants picked up and went right back into an identical business which it operated.
How do we know that? I mean, if Mr. Astorita was in meetings in 1995 at which the Redisys name came up, isn't there a time at which attention has, where we have a link between Cablevision and the problems that the Redisys are causing in this industry, enough of a link for at least inquiry notice?
Is the question, is there enough of a link?
Well, I'm just saying, how do you have stated as a proposition, you argue in your brief that there's no way Cablevision would have known that the Redisys or any of their enterprises were back in the business of illegal descrambler boxes before 1998. Mr. Klein has argued that your own man was in meetings in 1995 at which the Redisys themselves were discussed. And I'm uncomfortable with the level of information in the record.
Okay. The record is clear that Mr. Astorita attended meetings with the FBI both prior to the execution of the search warrant and after the execution. And the record is also clear that the FBI investigated and served search warrants on many, many pirate decoder operations across the United States when it did so against the Redisys. The level of information that he had was interpreted by the district court to be that information which was discussed in connection with the investigation and the subsequent prosecution of the Redisi operation and other operations.
But how did the district court know that without anyone ever asking the man?
Without anyone having asked
Mr.
Astorita.
Well, isn't he the one who knows what he knew better than anyone else's inferential guesses?
No question. The defendants knew from the date that this case first appeared in front of Judge Castillo that Judge Castillo was placing this on a fast track. And the reason why he did so was because there was no dispute as to the illegality of the operation, and very little dispute that that operation damaged Cablevision based upon the evidence proffered in support of its temporary restraining order.
Right, but if you have to pay for usage of X number of de-scrambler boxes for a two-year period, it's different from paying for, you know, X plus Y number of boxes for an eight-year period. It just, I mean, obviously there's a certain amount at stake, and we have lots of areas of the law where the statute of limitations will reach back 2 years, even if the illegal act, or 4 years, or whatever the pertinent statute may be. Happens all the time in antitrust cases where somebody will bring a treble damage action. They can recover their damages for sales for the last 4 years, but not for the last 14.
Let me direct my comment as to why Mr. Astorita wasn't deposed. And there's much discussion in the record that there was an abuse of discretion. The defendants sat on their hands for June, July, and August without noticing any depositions. When the defendants added, not substituted, but added new counsel in late August, new counsel then served deposition subpoenas on Friday prior to Labor Day for the subsequent business day, 1,000 miles away from where the witnesses were located.
But they basically had to, right? Because the cutoff for discovery was coming up. They couldn't have noticed the depositions for 3 weeks later because they would have been after the cutoff.
The cutoff for the summary judgment was coming up, which they knew about. And they participated in the scheduling of.
Sure. It wasn't a random choice of dates, though. I mean, I guess that's all.
So the plaintiff did produce many of those witnesses, and discovery did continue. They made then a motion to compel the deposition of Mr. Astorita. And on September 15th, Judge Castillo held his, what was probably his seventh or eighth conference in this case. It was very closely monitored. And Judge Castillo rejected the motion to compel the discovery based upon relevance and invited the defendants to produce additional evidence. He if I may, what I'm going to do is keep an open mind as I read the rest of the briefs come in, and I might change my position. But at this point, the motion to compel the deposition is going to be denied without prejudice to its renewal, September 15th at page 14 of the transcript. The defendant's counsel chose not to pursue that for 3 months until the time this summary judgment motion was determined. The abuse of discretion was not on the part of the judge. The defendants chose not to pursue this line, and they did so, I would submit, because there was no evidence available to them to pursue it. They certainly had access.
That there was no more evidence. In other words, they made their case, and that was it.
Perhaps, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to indicate otherwise.
I would like to get to damages, too, although I don't mean to cut you off on this point, but let me just put before you a theoretical problem I have with the way the district court approached damages, and I see very little in the way of Court of Appeals consideration of these issues. The statute allows a plaintiff like Cablevision to recover either statutory damages or actual damages suffered, and the actual damages suffered might be measured by the profits it would have earned if these people had been subscribers, or they might be measured by the usage that people who have free access to cable have. Now, it's intuitively obvious to me that if you're a subscriber, you're probably not going to watch 10 pay-per-view movies a month plus 5 more pay-per-view services. And at the very least, there's no evidence whatsoever that that's the average pay-per-view habits of Cablevision subscribers, or that's the top 15th percentile, or that's anything. That number, to me, comes quite out of the air. But obviously, you know, simple economics would suggest to you that people will use more of something the lower the price is, and if the price is all the way down at free, they'll use the most of it, and if they're paying $80 a month plus you know, 350 or whatever, 395 per pay-per-view, they will use less. That's just your downward sloping demand curve. And when one reads the statutory language of 47 U.S.C. Section 553, we need to interpret what actual damages means. Does it mean the opportunity loss that Cablevision had from the failure to have these people as subscribers, or does it mean, you know, the sky's the limit?
I mean,
they could have watched TV 24 hours a day. I don't know why you have any limit. Maybe they just do nothing but watch pay-per-view.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the devices that were sold by the Radicis and their various entities are devices that give access of the owner of that device to all the...
Oh, I understand that. My problem is, if they had never sold those devices to... you know, to John Doe might have purchased a certain number of pay-per-view movies, and you must have statistics about what your subscribers do. Maybe some people never buy pay-per-view, maybe some people, you know, have a more sedentary lifestyle and they buy 10 a month. I'm sure it probably varies across the subscriber base, but there would be business records of how much gets sold, which could be used to derive information from. And since the marginal cost of picking up anything with these illegal boxes is probably close to zero, you know, once the signal's out there, you know, it doesn't really cost you any more depending on how many people pick it up. So, of course, the rate structure is different from a marginal cost pricing structure. I'm not sure whether when we read the statute we should assume that actual damages are the value of everything viewed, or whether actual damages are the lost profits that Cablevision would have had, since no one would have viewed that much if they'd been paying for it. It's an interpretation question that I've been struggling with in this case.
I understand, Your Honor. Obviously, it's the position of Cablevision that actual damages ought to be interpreted as the value of the services watched by the person not paying anything.
Has any court of appeals ever said that?
No, Your Honor, there has not been that decision.
Did your cost increase with the volume of services rendered? Had people watching the movie 10 rather than 7 times, is that costing, does the company in effect have to pay for the extra 3 times?
No, Your Honor, not to my knowledge. It hasn't been briefed and hasn't been analyzed in the record, but it seems that would be, your presumption is correct, that the value, that the product is out in the cable, and if it's siphoned off, that doesn't result in an additional cost. It results in a theft of something that has intellectual property value, which the neighbor of the person who stole would pay either $4.95 for that particular movie, and honestly has paid $4.95, but this person received that for free. The analysis was not made in the record as to that. The analysis depended upon the value of a realm of reasonable assumptions of what would have been stolen by a person not paying for anything.
The record does show that your costs were substantial, though, for this service, weren't they?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The record does show that your costs were substantial for this service.
Oh, absolutely.
And let me ask you this. Why didn't you produce your rates pre-1999 for purposes of the damages calculation? I think it was based on 1999 figures. Why didn't you use the figures before, since you're claiming damages for a substantial period before 99?
Yes, Your Honor. All assumptions contained in the damages figures were assumptions. It was acknowledged by Cablevision that there was no way to demonstrate to the court what actual damages occurred, because these are thieves stealing in secret in the privacy of their own homes.
But you knew what your rates were.
That's my point. Weren't the rates different in the earlier years, or was the rate consistently $4.95 for all the years prior to?
Yes, there was testimony that there were marginal differences in the rates, and Cablevision, because of the insufficiency of of their ability to demonstrate what the actual specific actual damages were in each household stealing produced this as an assumption which the district court could use to base its calculations on.
Now, you made your damages calculation in April of 2000, but didn't really turn over the material until August of 2000. Why was there that gap? Why wasn't that turned over to the defendants earlier?
Okay. The defendants, as a predicate to this, the defendants had access to everything of theirs which this was based upon. From the date of the seizure throughout the litigation. Now, the defendants have made some issue as to whether or not they had proper access to it, but Judge Castillo made it clear, and the plaintiffs certainly followed that order, to make access to that to those seized items, including the computers and the records contained in the computers that these calculations were based on.
How about your own customer lists? Did they have access to that?
No, they did not. They had requested access to that. Judge Castillo rejected that on the fact that it wasn't he wasn't going to turn over Cablevision's proprietary information to essentially what were cable thieves.
But, you know, there are protective orders that are put in place in cases like that, even in criminal cases where it might be available only for the lawyers to review, or there might be in-camera review so that one can make sure that people don't abuse the information. It's really troublesome to think that you don't have the information to defend yourself on damages. I don't know why the district court didn't consider some sort of protective order arrangement.
Your Honor, a cable operator in Title 47 is not allowed to produce proprietary information about its customers. I think Judge Castillo took that into account and also took into account the fact that only persons within the operating zip codes were being used for this damage calculation. Okay. With respect to the damage calculation, I'd just like to make the final point that the plaintiff at all times did indicate to the court that these were assumptions and necessarily had to be because the theft was in secret and the defendants sold their devices and as secretive devices and used that secretiveness as a marketing tool.
But that all being true, other cases that are cited in your brief create some kind of factual grounding for the assumptions, something other than just, well, this is what I think, you know, and I read another case that said this. I'm disturbed by the lack of any empirical base for these assumptions.
Well,
none whatsoever.
The empirical base is based on a couple of things. First, the assumption that a person wasn't stealing the entire package of service. It started from a reasonable base of family service. And that
why would you even assume that? Why wouldn't you assume they were stealing the entire universe? A lot of apartments and houses are already wired up for cable. All you have to do is, you know, screw in your little cable and you're in business. I don't know where this comes from.
The plaintiff attempted to offer the district court conservative estimates of how a person would use this device for theft.
So why is 10 a month conservative instead of 5 a month or maybe 20 a month is conservative? What is your base for thinking that?
There is evidence in the record that there are up to 10 pay-per-view channels offering programming around the clock 24 hours a day. And there is that at Judge Castillo, in reviewing that evidence, accepted the basis that a movie.
Well, I know he accepted that, but I'm trying to find out, is there any shred of empirical evidence about what happens out there in the world in terms of people's viewing habits? I mean, you know, you can get digital cable now that has 230 channels, and I'm sure most people don't sit around and watch 230 channels a month.
There is no empirical data that would indicate to a court what the value of something stolen was, which is what we were confronted
with. But the question is how much was stolen? Is there any empirical data about at least how many units were stolen?
How many units of viewing?
How many hours?
There is nothing like that that was presented to the court, and certainly at the time of preparing this, there was nothing like that available.
And so you didn't even know, in terms of your own customers, how often your own customers ordered movies?
Not the customers that were stealing.
No, but I mean your legitimate customers who didn't have the illegal box. You're telling us you didn't know how many movies your regular customers were using?
No, that's not.
So you know how much your regular customers who were legitimately paying for the service were using?
Absolutely.
So the question is, why didn't you use that as the base for the number for the damages?
Our argument was that there was no relationship to a person who had access for free.
So you're saying that somebody that used it for free would just use it, so there wouldn't. But wouldn't knowing what your regular customers, what if your regular customers, order two movies a month? Then might it be more reasonable to say, well, since you got it free, it might be twice as much, four movies a month? How do you get to 10?
Based upon what is in the record, that being that there is access 24 hours
a day. Yes, you're just saying, just purely because of access, not using any empirical numbers on regular, legitimate usage. And you're saying that would have been irrelevant.
There was no connection between what an honest customer was purchasing and what a person with this device was purchasing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lefkowitz. Mr. Klein, 3.5 minutes. I'll do my best not to use it all. I just really do have a couple of points I would like to make. First, Judge Coffey raised went into the timing issue. Judge Ripple, oh my goodness, excuse me. Judge Ripple raised the timing issue with respect to Astorita or inquired about it. The summary judgment motions were due on September 10th. And it was very clear that the district court was not going to extend that. And that is obviously why they pursued the deposition of Astorita as far as they could at that point. What counsel was referring to, the later attempts, had to do with damages. And again, where timing was not an issue, Judge Castillo rejected that. I would also like to comment on a point that I think Judge Williams asked about the 1999 rates, or perhaps it was Judge Wood, I forgot. Flame, their damage expert, did say that he understood the earlier rates were lower than 1999. And one of the other things that you have to factor into this is that in 1991, 1992, there's obviously, if at all, there were things like pay-per-view and movies, we don't know what the cost of that is either. So there's still, I think, yet another reason why the use of the 1999 damage figures obviously top-loaded the damage result, and why I think the earlier years would have been very pertinent. And that's one of the other things that we didn't have the opportunity to look at. With respect to the computers, vis-a-vis the, and I guess I'm going to call them the replicated invoices, which were used as the basis for some of this. Those invoices, and I think discovery closed, the damage discovery closed, I believe, March 31, and those invoices were not produced until, I believe, 2 or 3 days before the damage trial, which was in September. And that is, I think, a very practical reason why it didn't matter whether abstractly they had the opportunity or had access to their computers. This material was all dumped on them literally at the eve of trial, and obviously there was no opportunity to go back and see if, do any kind of a search to see if this was a legitimate use of their computer information. I believe I will stop at the moment unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Well, let me ask you, did you propose any other alternative to Judge Castile in terms of reviewing the customer list, like a protective order or maybe having a court's expert look at the...
I don't believe they specifically asked for a protective order, but I think what Judge Castile said, I think kind of precluded it overwhelmingly. I think what he said is that he had no intention of turning over customer list information to these kinds of people, and if he did, he would resign his seat on the bench. And so I think that was fair to gather from that he wasn't about to entertain any alternate motion at that point either. And again, the timing became a rather critical issue. And I apologize again, Judge Ripple.
Indeed, our thanks to both Mr. Klein and Mr. Lefkowitz for their fine presentations this morning. The case will be taken under advisement.